During my many years of research into the religion and to the teachings of Islam, I have gathered dozens of books that I have purchased from various Islamic centers and mosques throughout the United States. For example, I picked up this book several years ago entitled Introduction to Islam by Dr. Muhammad Hamid Dullah. This is an English translation of a book which originally appeared in French from the Islamic Cultural Center in Paris. As a matter of fact, this book is viewed as being so authoritative when it comes to the teachings of Islam that it is translated into English, French, Turkish, German, Arabic, Afrikaans, Yugoslavian, Tamil, and Indonesian. So this is one of the books that I was handed years ago when I began my search for truth concerning Allah, Muhammad, and the Quran. As I read this book, I read the following statement on page 23. The teachings of Islam are based primarily on the Quran and the Hadith. And as we shall presently see, both are based on divine inspiration. Thus, the Hadith is the record of what the Prophet said, yet did not order to incorporate in the Quran also what he did. This immediately indicated to me that there were two sources of authority in the religion of Islam. You have the written source in the Quran, composed of the 114 surahs, that were put together by the Caliph Uthman after Muhammad died. But you also had an authoritative source of extra-Quranical or Quranic revelations and teachings and actions of Muhammad that are found in the traditions or what is called the Hadith. Now this book goes on to speak of the Hadith as being the second source of teaching concerning the religion of Islam, and particularly it states on page 163 that the Hadith is the basis of all Islamic law. As I investigated other books published by Muslim scholars, I found universally that Muslims observe the authority and inspiration of two sets of writings, the Quran, which they call the Holy Quran, but also the Hadith is viewed as being inspired and authoritative and something that is binding upon Muslims today. Well, in order for me to find the Hadith was indeed a very difficult measure. It took several years of looking for it. I found part of it in one well-known library. Finding the Hadith to read and to study was a very difficult task. Indeed, many Muslims do not own the Hadith. They have never read it themselves, though they know that the practices that they observe when they go to the mosque, the various washings that they go through in order to be prepared for prayers. They understand that much of Islamic law concerning one's private bathroom duties and things of this nature are to be found in the Hadith, but not in the Quran itself. But finally, I discovered a source that would sell me the 9 volumes, of course, of the great Islamic work done by Mr., and you can see the name, Bukhari or al-Bukhari, who, during his lifetime, collected over 300,000 hadiths, that is, these sayings of Muhammad not found in the Quran. He sifted through them, and though he memorized 200,000 of them, he reduced them to just a little over 7,200 as being the most authentic extra-Quranic statements, teachings, and living examples of Muhammad that are to be viewed as being inspired. Thus, when you open the work, and this is a translation by Dr. Muhammad Khan, you find immediately that his work receives the approval of all of the greatest Islamic scholars. Indeed, as you turn to the front, you find that it has what I would simply say is indeed the measure that has to do with the seal of approval from Mecca, from Medina. And in it we learn concerning the hadith the following statements. Here in the introduction it states, "In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful, regarding Imam Bukhara and his book, Al-Bukhara, it has been unanimously agreed that Imam Bukhara's work is the most authentic of all the other works in hadith literature put together. The authenticity of Al-Bukhara's work is such that the religious learned scholars of Islam say concerning him," now I'm quoting the quote, "the most authentic book after the book of Allah, that is Al-Quran, is Al-Bukhari. Many a story has been told concerning Imam Bukhari in his struggles in collecting hadith literature. Having noticed the great need of those Muslims who do not know Arabic to learn the correct hadiths of Allah's apostle, and since Al-Bukhara is regarded as the most reliable book of the Prophet's hadiths, I have undertaken the project of translating the meanings of the hadith it contains into English to serve my Muslim brethren who know this language but have not had the chance to learn Arabic." He goes on to say that Allah revealed to Muhammad the glorious Quran and the second inspiration, that is, his traditions or the hadith. And thus he appeals to the Muslims. He said, "Thus Allah says it is incumbent upon you to strive hard to do righteous deeds according to the traditions of Muhammad, as is clearly expressed in his hadith." Thus, the 9-volume set, which has, as a matter of fact, the Arabic on one side and the English on the other, is the most authoritative source of Al-Bukhara's work on the hadith, not only in the Arabic but also in the English. And as the introduction states, as a foreword by the leaders both of Mecca and Medina, that the 9-volume set of Al-Bukhara's work on the hadith is inspired, it is the word of God, and the Muslims must believe it and they must live according to it. This means that we have a right as Westerners to examine the teachings and practices of Muhammad as given in the hadith in order to see if this man is really a prophet. I have done so in a brief booklet entitled An Analysis of the Hadith. In this booklet, I go through many subjects in which I give you the very volume and the number keyed into the 9-volume set, almost 5,000 pages, of Al-Bukhari's work as translated by the great professor in Medina, the Islamic University, Dr. Muhammad Khan. I give you the volume number. For example, if I tell you it's volume 1, you would turn to volume 1, and then I would give you the name of the hadith by its number. For example, here in volume 1, chapter 8, here we are told in hadith 63, Uthman got the Quran compiled and sent a few of its copies to far-off places. Thus, the hadith will give us the history of the Quran. It is the hadith that tells us that that 360 idols were worshipped at the Kaaba in Mecca. It is in the hadith we learn that Aisha, depending on how you want to pronounce her name, the favorite wife of Muhammad, was only 6, according to her testimony, when she married Muhammad. And then, when he took her to bed and consummated that marriage, she was only 9 years old, according to the hadith. Thus, when we study the hadith, we are studying many of the things not found in the Quran, but nevertheless they are to be viewed as being inspired, and a Muslim must put them forth as proof that Muhammad was the Prophet of God. I cannot, in the brief time that we have, simply quote to you each of the hadiths. We would be here for weeks. As I said, it's 9 volumes, almost 5,000 pages of Al-Bukhari. Instead, I will give you some of the material in terms of the reference, and then I hope at some point in the future that I will be able to do an edition of this material where I will have the hadith recorded on the right-hand side and my comments on the left, so that there will be no question that what I'm saying is unimpeachably correct according to the writings. I first of all want to look at the hadith in terms of its view of Muhammad as a man. For first of all, we must say that even the Quran says that Allah said to Muhammad, "Say, I am but a man." Thus, we are looking at the man, Muhammad. The first thing that we are told, even in volume 1, as to his race, Muhammad was a white man. He was not a black man. He was not an Oriental. And as anthropology teaches, there are only 3 basic races. You have the Mongoloid, you have the Negroid, and the Caucasoid. And Muhammad, according to the Hadith, was a white man. That's why in volume 1, Hadith number 63, and again, you would turn to the volume, all the Hadiths are numbered, and here we read the statement that while we were sitting with the Prophet in the mosque, a man came riding on a camel. He made his camel kneel down in the mosque, tied its foreleg, and then said, "Who amongst you is Muhammad?" At that time, the Prophet was sitting amongst us, that is his companions, leaning on his arm. We replied, "This white man, leaning on his arm." And the man then addressed him, "O son of Abdul Muttalib," whatever you may want to pronounce that. Thus, we find in this statement and in subsequent statements that describe the whiteness of the armpits of Muhammad when he would raise his arms in prayer. It would even describe the whiteness of his legs, or the color of the skin of his private parts were described as being distinctively white, in order that the reader would understand that the early Muslims did not want anyone to think for one moment that Muhammad was a black man. As a matter of fact, in the Hadith, black people are referred to as raisin heads and are usually always referred to in the sense of being slaves that are owned by their Muslim Arab masters. Now, this becomes important only when you're dealing with Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. Our Arab friends, they know that Muhammad was a white man. But the black Muslims who ply their religious trinkets in their magazines and newspapers on the streets in the ghettos of Chicago and New York City and Los Angeles and etc., they have told their people that Islam is the black man's religion because Muhammad was a black man, Jesus was a black man, and that all the biblical prophets were black men. Solomon was a black man. David was a black man. I've had many, many black Muslims tell me with great confidence, Muhammad was a black man, Jesus was a black man. And at the same time, the black Muslims say, "I believe in the Hadith as well as the Quran." Well, the Hadith states that Muhammad was a white man. And even further, it says that in the night journey, when Muhammad supposedly traveled through 7 heavens, he met Jesus during this dream. And in the Hadith, Muhammad describes Jesus as a white man with long, straight hair. Thus, for a black Muslim to claim to be a Muslim, he must accept the authority of the Hadith. And having said that he accepted the authority of the Hadith, well, then Muhammad was a white man. Jesus was a white man. They were not part of the Negro race. You say, "Well, what difference does that make, Dr. Morey? Who cares?" Ah, my dear friend, it makes a great deal of difference. For you see, according to the teachings of Wallace Fard, Elijah Muhammad, and Louis Farrakhan, And those who followed him, and initially Malcolm X, and of course Cassius Clay became Muhammad Ali. And you've got other athletes and movie stars who take upon themselves these Arab names. And they say, well, this is in order to instill our blackness. Then they tell us that white people are devils. Yes, that's right. That white people are devils, that they were not created by Allah. They were created by this black man who was a god, for there are many gods in amongst the black Muslims, 24. Yaqub created the white man out of the evil side of the universe. It sounds like Star Wars. And people, white people are evil, but they can't help it. They were made that way, says Louis Farrakhan. That's simply the way they are. But think for a moment, ladies and gentlemen. Having said that white people are devils, now we find that Muhammad was a white person. Jesus was a white person. And even more shocking, ladies and gentlemen, is the truth that the founder of the nation of Israel, Wallace Fard himself, was a white man. He was not a black man. Anyone who looks at his photograph sees that he is a Caucasian. He was not at all of the Negro race, and thus the founder of the nation of Islam was a white devil, according to the teachings of Elijah Muhammad and Louis Farrakhan. Well, you see, ladies and gentlemen, how the hadith forces itself even into the issue of the black Muslims, which reveals that they are not Muslims at all. They are simply a racism, a religion of racism that cloaks itself in Islamic paraphernalia. It uses the crescent stars. They want to put on Arab dress and strut around in Arab dress and gowns. Put caps on their head. They're not Muslims. They have nothing to do with Islam. And one of the clearest ways is when they proclaim that Muhammad was a black man, when the hadith says Muhammad was a white man. This is important as to the statement. When Muhammad referred to black people as raisin heads, you can find this in Volume 1, Hadith number 662, Volume 9, Hadith number 256, and even more insulting to our black audience, in Volume 9, Numbers Hadith 162 and 163, Muhammad said in his book on dream interpretation, which was one of the occultic arts as a shaman that he practiced, he said, if you dream of a black woman, it is an evil omen of a coming pestilence or disease. One black friend said to me, I dream of black women all the time. And it's an insult to the black race when Muhammad said, to dream of a black woman is an evil omen of coming disaster. In terms of his basic personality type, we are told in the hadith that Muhammad was short-tempered, easily angered. He would get fully red in the face. He would steam. He would get excited. He would get furious. For example, in Volume 1, Hadith number 90, I never saw the Prophet more furious in giving advice than he was on that day. Or again, Hadith number 91 in Volume 1, the Prophet got angry and his cheeks became red with rage. You see, Muhammad did not like anyone to ask him questions about his claims to being a prophet. He went so far in Volume 2, Hadith number 555, Volume 3, Hadith number 591. Listen to these words. Quote, Allah has hated you for asking too many questions, end quote. How would you like to have a religious leader who says, if you ask questions, God hates you for asking questions? For example, it says in Volume 1, Hadith number 92, the Prophet was asked about things which he did not like. When the questioner insisted, the Prophet got angry. Thus, we read in Hadith number 92, Volume 1, quote, those who asked the question saw the anger on the face of Muhammad, and they would withdraw their questions. Thus, in terms of his basic attitude, his basic personality. Volume 1, Hadith number 30, the Prophet told them repeatedly in anger to ask him anything they like, but when they asked him questions, then he got angry, and they learned not to ask any questions. Now, the fact in the Hadith is that Muhammad did not have any sense of humor. He did not allow anyone to crack jokes or to make fun of his pagan deity, Allah, or his worship ceremonies that he adopted from various pagan Arab religions. Thus, he had no sense of humor, particularly when it came to religious issues. We find in Volume 2, Hadith 173, a very sad story. The Muslims at that time prided themselves on the fact that when they prayed at the Kaaba, they went all the way to the ground and got dirt on their forehead. Boy, this was an example of pride. We are the followers of Allah and of Muhammad, his apostle. We have dirt on our forehead. Well, there was an old man sitting there by the Kaaba, and he said, well, huh? He picked up some dirt, rubbed it on his head, and said, that's sufficient for me. Do you get the jokes, ladies and gentlemen? If the big deal of strutting around is to have dirt on your forehead, and that means you're just holy and righteous, well, the old man picked up some dirt and put it on his forehead. He said, well, then why bother bowing down? Just pick it up and running in, and that's it. Trouble is, the man was ordered to be murdered, and as we read in the Hadith, the man was murdered in cold blood. Not only was Muhammad short-tempered, easily angered, no sense of humor, but he was a bitter and vengeful man. He believed in killing people who got on his bad side. He would even ask people, is there anyone here who will kill so-and-so for me? For example, in Volume 3, Hadith number 687, we read that Allah's prophet went into the pulpit and asked, who will kill Ka'b bin? And then he names the man as he has harmed Allah and his apostle. And then immediately a man jumped up in the congregation and said, quote, I will kill him. And the man went out and used deception and lies, murdered the man, stabbing him in the back cowardly, and then returned rejoicing that he had done the prophet's work for him. In this particular case and others, you find that tribal conflicts often arose because one person from a different tribe would be all too willing to kill someone from another tribe at the instigation of the prophet himself. Now, this immediately reveals the fact that we're not dealing with someone who was sinless. And you see, this is one of the sore points between Christians and Muslims. At first, as we shall see from the Hadith and the Quran itself, early Muslims did not view Muhammad as being sinless. They never taught that doctrine. It never entered their minds. Muhammad never claimed to be sinless. In the debate with some of the Muslims at the University of Texas, I asked some of the young men, show me in the Quran where Muhammad claimed to be sinless, or where Allah said that he was sinless. They couldn't find such a place. Instead, in the Quran, as you find in my book, Islamic Invasion, there you have from the Quran where Allah himself commands Muhammad to ask forgiveness for his sins. Would you please look at what the Hadith gives us? For example, we learn in Volume 1, Hadith number 711, what do you say in the pause between different prayers? Muhammad replied, I say, O Allah, set me apart from my sins as the east and west are set apart from each other, and clean me from sins as a white garment is cleansed of dirt. O Allah, wash off my sins with water, snow, and hail. I go on in the booklet to give you many such instances. Here's another one, Hadith number 319, Volume 8. I heard Allah's apostle saying, by Allah, I ask for forgiveness from Allah and turn to him in repentance more than 70 times a day. That's what it says, ladies and gentlemen. According to this authentic Hadith, verified by Mecca and Medina, Muhammad had to ask for forgiveness for his sins 70 times a day. Thus, when we look at the teachings of the early Muslims, for example, in volume 1, hadith number 19, quote, they said, O Allah's apostle, we are not like you. Allah has forgiven your past and future sins. I go on to give 5 or 6 more references which clearly reveal that Muhammad was not sinless. As a matter of fact, according to the teaching of Muhammad in hadith number 506, volume 4, the only one not touched by Satan or polluted by sin at birth was Jesus of Nazareth. Thus, the sinner Muhammad admits that Jesus was the only sinless man that ever lived, not Muhammad. Thus, when Muslims would claim that Muhammad was sinless, they have to go against the clear teaching of the Quran and of the Hadith itself. In terms of his cultural context, Muhammad was a very typical superstitious Arab of the 9th century. Muhammad was afraid of the power of the evil eye. He was afraid of the, according to the Hadith, from being bewitched. He even believed that at times he was under the spell of witches and of evil spirits. And thus he told his followers, for example, in volume 7, number 636, how to fight the spell of the evil eye. He believed in good and bad omens, such as the appearance of certain birds and animals. You'll find this in volume 4 and volume 7 in many different hadiths. He was afraid that when he went to the bathroom, evil spirits would enter his body. Thus, he had a special prayer that he prayed when he went to the bathroom, because he was afraid that the evil spirits would enter in. He was afraid whenever a strong wind was blowing. Listen to this, volume 2, hadith number 144. Narrated Anas, whenever a strong wind blew, anxiety appeared on the face of the prophet, fearing that the wind might be a sign of Allah's wrath. It was not only the wind blowing that got him superstitious, but when there was a solar or lunar eclipse, this man went crazy. He would proclaim, this must be the judgment day, the end of the world. In Hadith number 167, volume 2, he was afraid, it says, that it might be the hour that is the day of judgment. We find his superstition being revealed by the worship and the kissing of the black stone, this pagan relic found in Mecca, which he kissed and adored, as volume 2, hadith number 667 reveals. He believed that those who were suffering in the grave could have their pains lessened if you put a green palm leaf, a branch from the tree, on the grave, and as that palm leaf dried in the desert sun, it would release those who were in that grave from suffering. Well, we could go on. He was superstitious about even numbers. He only wanted odd numbers. He believed in magic. He believed that people could be turned into rats, monkeys, and pigs. This is stated in volume 4, hadiths number 524, 568, and even in chapter 32. He states that the Jews, in particular, were transformed into rats. Whenever you saw a rat slinking in the cities, it was no doubt a Jew who had been turned into a rat. Again, hadith number 660, volume 7, we're reading this. Magic was working on Allah's apostle so that he used to think that he had had sexual relations with his wife while he actually had none. Here is supposedly Allah's prophet and apostle. And according to other hadiths, he had the sexual virility of 30 men and was able to have sex with the over 20 women in his harem every morning before prayers, because he arrived at the mosque to pray with his hair wet, having to have a bath because he had had relationships with his wife. But his own wives, according to the hadith, revealed there were times when Muhammad thought that he had had sex with his wives, when it was only magic working on him, a spell, a delusion. All you have to do is turn to volume 7 of al-Bukhari's hadith and read the hadiths from 656 all the way to 664, where you will read of all the superstitions, his fear of magic, his fear of soothsayers, his fear of the pagans, his fears of the wind and of this and of that. He was a superstitious man. He was also quite vain about his appearance. This is why he dyed his hair an orangish red color. I will now read from volume 1, hadith 167. And about the dyeing of hair with henna, no doubt I saw Allah's apostle dyeing his hair with it. And that is why I like to dye my hair with it. Volume 1, hadith number 167. Or again, you find this same statement in volume 4, hadith 741, and volume 7, hadith number 785, that after Muhammad had died, his wives had clipped some of this bright orangish hair with coloring from henna plant. And you can look in any encyclopedia, it turns your hair basically orange, so that he looked like Ronald McDonald, the clown of the McDonald hamburger industry. But even though he had this orangish red hair, he also had lice running in and out of his hair. Thus in volume 9, hadith 130, it states that he sat there while a woman went through his hair looking for lice, combing out the lice. Now some Muslim would say, well, he didn't really have any lice. She was just there looking for lice. Well, let me tell you, my wife has never looked into my head for lice. You would look into someone's hair for lice if they had lice. You don't look otherwise. He had lice upon him. In terms of his sexual appetite, Muhammad was a man of extremes, a man who claimed many things, a man who had, as we are told in volume 1, hadith number 268, the Prophet was given the sexual strength of virility of 30 men. The Prophet used to visit all his wives and around during the day and the night. And he had 11 in number. And of course a friend said, well, did he have the strength for it? Of course he had the sexual strength of 30 men. Aisha said, quote, I scented Allah's Prophet and he went around and had sex with all his wives. Volume 1. Hadith number 270, hadith number 267, also volume 7, many of these instances. We know, and I have pointed out in the Quran itself, that Muhammad had over 20 women. He had 11 or 12 wives, depending on how many were alive at that time. He had also slaves and concubines. For example, in volume 1, hadith number 367, he purchased a young woman who had been captured in a Muslim raid and kept her as a sex slave. Or again, we have women devotees who, like today, who offer themselves to rock stars. They offer their sexual favors to Jim Jones or to Joseph Smith, the false prophet of Mormonism. Here we read in volume 3, hadith number 505a, a woman came to Allah's Prophet and said, Oh, Allah's Apostle, I want to give myself to you, end quote. And Muhammad would look her up and down. If she were a looker, into the harem she went. If she wasn't quite up to standards, he would give her to one of his men, where she would then be forced into a life of sex and slavery in another man's harem. Thus, you had many people involved in terms of Muhammad's sexual activities. The worst, of course, is that of Aisha, who was only 9 years old when Muhammad took her to his wedding bed. Thus, we begin to see from the hadith itself some of the clues that we can understand this man Muhammad. A man given to passion, a man who would feel rage and anger if you question him. A man who would give himself to sexual exploitation of others. A man who would conquer. A man who was involved in fighting and in military might. He was not the kind of man that was like the Lord Jesus Christ. But he was a man who was an empire builder. Someone who came to build an earthly kingdom and not at all like Jesus, who came to build a heavenly kingdom. As a prophet, we are told one of the most amazing things. And ladies and gentlemen, you will not believe me. Some of you will be amazed. Some of you will be shocked. Some of you will simply not believe it. Even when I show you in black and white what the Hadith tells us concerning the seal of the Prophet of Muhammad. Did you realize that in Arab, in Saudi Arabia, among the Arab people of the 7th century, that there was a physical sign present when someone was a prophet of Allah? The sign was a fatty tumor or lump between the shoulder blades up on the neck, basically over here. Thus we read, ladies and gentlemen, in Hadith number 189, volume 1, we read, "And I drank from the remaining water, I stood behind him and saw the seal of prophethood between his shoulders, and it was like the button of a small tent, but some said, like the egg of a partridge." Ladies and gentlemen, the Hadith states that they knew that Muhammad was a prophet of Allah because he had a lump, a fatty tumor, a mosquito bump, a bite from a scorpion. We don't know what it is, but it was about the size of a partridge egg, probably a fatty tumor, between his shoulder blades. And thus we are told in this Hadith, and also in volume 4, Hadith number 741, that Muhammad was a true prophet because he had a lump about the size of a partridge or quail egg underneath his skin between his shoulder blades. Anyone living today, I think, would not be able to sustain such superstition. Someone is not a prophet of God because he's a dwarf. Someone is not a prophet of God because he's short or tall, fat or thin. He is not a prophet of God simply because he's physically deformed, like Muhammad, who had a fatty tumor between his shoulders. On what grounds possibly could this be said, except the superstitious Arabs of 7th century Arabia? In terms of his religious perspective, Muhammad was viewed as a shaman who controlled the spirits, who lived in the rocks, the waters, and the trees. He even supposedly converted the genies who went forth preaching then Islam. In terms of the physical manifestation that came upon Muhammad when he received his revelations, we are told, and I will have to ask you to get the material. You will see it for yourselves. I'm only going to summarize it, but if you look here, you see I give you the Hadith and the volume, and it is proven beyond the shadow of a doubt that if you and I were alive in the 7th century and we went to see, because there were those who said, "I want to see Allah's apostle when revelation is coming." And when they looked and examined, this is what they were told by Muhammad. This is what they were told by his wives. This is what they saw with their own eyes and heard with their own ears. Number one, Muhammad would experience ringing in his ears. Number two, his heart would begin to beat rapidly. Number three, his face turn a bright red. He would begin to breathe heavily. He would suddenly fall down or lie down as he felt the seizure coming. This is why in volume 4, Hadith 461, Muhammad said, "I fell on the ground." Or again, he fell down unconscious on the ground with both his eyes open toward the sky. And you find this in Hadith number 170, volume 5. Or again, volume 6, Hadith number 448, Muhammad said, "I fell down on the ground." This is not something that was inserted in al-Bukhara's hadith by Western scholars. The fact that Muhammad had ringing in the ear, heart palpitations, he turned red in his face, he fell on the ground. It goes on to say he would ask to be covered, or they would cover him with a sheet or a blanket. For example, in volume 6 on 4 hadiths, he said, I fell on the ground and said, cover me with a blanket, cover me. Then Allah sent a revelation, O you wrapped up in a blanket. Muhammad's lips would begin to tremble. His chin would begin to quiver. His lips would begin to shake. He heard and saw things that no one else heard and saw. They were strictly in the mind. He would begin to sweat profusely. The hadith puts it as drops of pearls. He would sometimes snore like a camel. He would sometimes dream. No, people, understand me. Any Muslims listening to this video, I'm not offending Muhammad. I'm simply reporting to you what it says in your hadith. I didn't write this. I just read it. And I am reporting to you what it says line for line. So when I read it as an intelligent person with earned degrees in an academic manner, and I must say it is clear that Muhammad had some kind of mental seizure. These are the physical characteristics of epilepsy or some other thing. Anyone who denies that will have to come up with a medical explanation that explains away these things without coming to the conclusion that Muhammad had mental problems. Thirdly, we come to the miracles of Muhammad. Now, in the Quran, there are no miracles for Muhammad. The only miracle that he claimed that he had was the Quran. That was the miracle. No other miracles. But you see, after he died, the Muslims felt intimidated by the Jews and the Christians who said, look at our prophets and apostles and Jesus, the patriarchs, they all had miracles and Muhammad had none. So even though Muhammad was dead, the early Muslims decided, let's invent some miracles for Muhammad. I found in the hadith 20 miracles for Muhammad. He cut the moon in half, according to the hadith. Now, that meant either he had a very long sword, and it reached a great distance, and it must have been mighty big, or the moon was very small. Either the sword was very big or the moon was very small, and he cut it in half like you cut a watermelon. Well, of course, the Arabs believed that the sun and the moon were about the size of a basketball, and thus the idea that he reached and pulled out his sword and cut the moon in the half, of course, is something they would have believed. But this so-called miracle of Muhammad is found in over a dozen hadiths where he supposedly cut the moon in half. Another is the crybaby palm tree. He used to cry it. He used to preach under a certain palm tree. And when instead a pulpit was built for him and he went into the pulpit to preach, the palm tree began to cry like a baby. And he left the pulpit and he came and he caressed the tree as the tree cried. Till finally the baby tree was okay. This is a miracle of which there is no biblical parallel. Also, you find that there were miracles that were invented to parallel what Moses did. Remember, Moses provided water in the wilderness? Well, in many, over a dozen hadiths, we are told that when the Muslims needed water, Muhammad provided miracle water for the Muslims. And the water flowed out of his fingernails. Now, did you get that? He put his hand over a bucket, and the water flowed out of his fingernails into the bucket, and they poured it into the other buckets, till all the people, the soldiers, the camels, the donkeys, everybody had enough water. Well, how many people had this water from the fingernails of Muhammad? Well, one hadith says 70 people. Another hadith says 80 people. Yet another says 300. But then other hadiths say 1,500. And you see, this proves that the hadiths contradict themselves. How could this be inspired when they cannot even agree on how many people received the miracle fingernail water from Muhammad? Or again, multiplying bread. Remember how Jesus fed the multitude and he broke the bread? He had the people come forth in groups and he passed it out. Muhammad is said to feed the multitudes by multiplying bread, so that you have the miracles of Moses, the miracles of Jesus put into the life of Muhammad, and even the sayings of Jesus are put into the mouth and on the tongue of Muhammad. Or again, talking food. How would you like to sit at a banquet? And the carrot begins to shout praises to Allah. And you reach forth to get a piece of bread and it begins to shout. And you go to get a piece of lamb and it begins to say, Allah, Allah, Allah. Well, according to the hadith, in volume 4, hadith number 779, the food would shout out loud and glorify Allah as Muhammad ate it. I don't know about you, but I wouldn't be eating any food that was shouting and carrying on. The open grave. There was a man who was once a Muslim, then reconverted to Christianity. He died and he was buried, but the earth would not accept his body, but coughed it out of the grave. This, the hadith claims, was a miracle of Muhammad. Muhammad could multiply heaps of dates. He could guess the number of dates. Muhammad's chest was slit open and his intestines washed with Zamzam water, according to volume 1, hadith number 345. And after Gabriel had opened him up and washed him, then he poured in wisdom and knowledge and faith into his chest cavity. We also have the fact that there was a Muslim who had a problem remembering the hadiths. So what Muhammad did, according to volume 1 and volume 4, was that he told the man to get a sheet. And the man took his sheet off and laid it on the ground. And then Muhammad pretended invisibly to be picking up something and to be putting it in this sheet. And he said, what you doing? I'm putting in the hadiths into the sheet. Put the sheet on. The man put the sheet on and he said, ah, I never forgot another hadith. Muhammad was a rainmaker. He was a drought maker. He gave prophecies of wind and of dates. He had healing power in his saliva and spit in order to mimic the miracle of Jesus, who used the spit with the dirt and rubbed into the eyes. This too is applied to Muhammad. And according to hadith number 641 and 642, many diseases could be healed by the spit or saliva of Muhammad. This is why when it came to dead people, Muhammad would even massage corpses with his saliva or spit. The reason that this was attributed is that Muhammad's spit was so miraculous that when there was a dry well, he spit into it, and the well filled with water from his holy spit. And he multiplied water. He caused it to grow. He rubbed a broken leg and healed it. Or, listen to this, and this is found in volume 7 of the hadith. Hadiths number 637, 638, 639, 640, 641, 642. Many, many, many hadiths. Listen to this. Snake bites, scorpion stings, all manner of diseases were healed by Muhammad as he waved his hand over the womb and recited the Quran. Healing took place. It looks like you're watching one of these modern televangelists who are out there fleecing the public through their spurious and fraudulent healing. And lastly, number 20, he was involved in dream interpretation. These are things that you find in the hadith, my dear friends. You do not find it anywhere else. You find it there. It is not in the Quran. It's also interesting to point out that in my various radio programs and television and debates with Muslims, I am often challenged by Muslims who say, well, how do you know there were 360 idols at the Kaaba? How do you know the Quran was not put together till after Muhammad's death? Why do you say Islam teaches that the Quran is perfect grammatically and 100% in the Arabic language. And why do you say all of these things? Friends, in the Hadith, and I give you the references, in the Hadith, it tells you those things. We're told in the Hadith that the Quran was written in heaven. We're told that there were no pre-Islamic sources for it. We're told that the Quran was written in the Quraysh dialect. We're told that the Quran, after Muhammad's death, was scattered on palm leaves, rocks, and bones. Volume 6, Hadith number 509. All of the things that I stated in my book, Islamic Invasion, are clearly documented in the Hadith. And lastly, I finished the booklet with Muhammad's Believe It or Not. Did you know that Muhammad taught that Adam was 90 feet tall? That if a fly fell in your water glass, don't worry, one wing had the antidote, the other wing the disease? That Muhammad said that dogs should be killed because angels would not enter a home where pictures or dogs are present? Where he said that a child looks like whichever parent gets the sexual climax first? That the stars were created by Allah as missiles to throw at the demons? And that the spirits or jinn eat human dung and bones? That Muhammad ordered people to be murdered? That Gabriel had 600 wings, according to Muhammad? That Satan stays in the upper part of your nose, so you should snort water up your nose and then blow it out? Believe me, it says that. Volume 4, Hadith number 516. When you're sick and have a fever, the fevers are from hell. Also, the water that Muhammad used as he took his bathing, his ceremonial washings, his followers fought over it to rub their bodies. They even, listen to this, volume 3, hadith number 891, by Allah, whenever Allah's apostle spit, the spittle would fall into the hand of one of the prophet's companions who would rub it on his face and skin. Did you know Satan urinates in the ears of those who fall asleep? That Allah will not hear the prayers of those who have bad breath, and yawning is from hell. These, then, are the very strange and mysterious teachings of Muhammad, which prove Allah is not God, Muhammad was not his prophet, and the Quran and the Hadith are not the word of God. This is the evidence. This is the source. If this is Muhammad's inspiration, then it falls to the ground as false prophecy and false teaching. There is but one God. Allah is not this God. This God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the blessed God of the Holy Scriptures and of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Thank you very much. For further information concerning the teachings of Islam, you can contact us at Research and Education Foundation, Post Office Box 141455, Austin, Texas 78714. That's P.O. Box 141455, Austin, Texas 78714.
This is a postscript to Dr. Morey's analysis of the Hadith. Reading from page 2 of his analysis of the Hadith, we read, the driving force. The driving force behind the Hadith is the all-consuming question, what must I do to be forgiven by Allah and to be admitted to paradise? In the Hadith, Muhammad does not give us vague generalities. He tells the reader exactly what to do, how to do it, and in what order to do it. For example, Muhammad lays down very specific rules about how, where, and in what way to urinate. Whether or not you follow these urination rules determines whether or not you end up in hellfire or paradise. The working assumption throughout the Hadith is that without Allah's forgiveness, no one may enter into paradise. Hellfire awaits those who do not gain Allah's favor. But to gain Allah's acceptance and forgiveness is no easy matter. One must earn Allah's forgiveness by following an elaborate set of rules and rituals. One mistake can cancel out all that you have done up to that point. There is no concept of salvation by grace in Hadith. The Hadith sets forth the rules and rituals which must be followed to earn salvation. Those Muslims who ignore these rules and rituals imperil their immortal souls. Reading from page 20 of Dr. Morey's work, Muhammad on Women, we read, Muhammad taught that the majority of the people in hell were women. The Prophet said, quote, I was shown the hellfire and that the majority of its dwellers were women. Volume 1, numbers 28, 301. Volume 2, number 161. The reason the majority of the people in hell were women is stated in volume 2, number 541. O women, I have not seen anyone more deficient in intelligence and religion than you. Muhammad believed that women were deficient in intelligence and thus they should not be given equal rights under Islamic law. For example, Muhammad legislated that a woman's testimony in court was worth only half that of a man. Thus, it would take the testimony of two women to offset the testimony of one man. Imagine what this would do to women who were raped. The Prophet said, isn't the witness of a woman equal to half that of a man? The woman said, yes. He said, this is because of the deficiency of a woman's mind. Volume 3, number 826. Muhammad even ruled that women were to receive only half of what their brothers receive in inheritance. Volume number 4, number 10. Thus women are financially punished for being females. Perhaps the most degrading picture of women is that paradise will have beautiful women whose only purpose is to satisfy the sexual urges of men. See volume 6, number 402. Also on page 20, Dr. Morey expounds on what Muhammad had to say about urine and feces. Muhammad had a psychological obsession with urine and feces. In fact, he spent a great deal of time teaching on where, when, and how to urinate and defecate. He was so obsessed with the subject that he taught that if someone got urine on his clothes or body, they suffered hellfire in the afterlife. Quote, one of the major sins is not to protect oneself, one's clothes and body, from one's urine, i.e., from being soiled with it. Once the Prophet, while passing one of the graveyards of Medina or Mecca, heard the voices of two persons being tortured in their graves. The Prophet then added, yes, they are being tortured for a major sin. Indeed, one of them never saved himself from being soiled with his urine. This is from Hadith Volume Number 1, Chapter 57, Number 215. According to Volume 2, Number 443, Muhammad said that people are tortured in hellfire because they soil themselves with urine. Yet at the same time, Muhammad ordered people to drink camel urine mixed in milk as medicine. Quote, so the Prophet ordered them to go to the herd of camels and drink their milk and urine as a medicine. Volume 1, number 234. The rules for urination and defecation are as follows. Number 1, you must not face Mecca while urinating or defecating. Volume number 1, numbers 146, 147, 150, 151. Number 2, you must not use your right hand or hold or wipe yourself. Volume number 1, numbers 155, 156. Number 3, you must wash your privates after going to the bathroom. Volume 1, numbers 152, 153, 154, and 157. Number 4, if you do hadah, i.e., if you pass wind through the anus while you are engaged in prayer, Allah will not hear your prayers. Volume number 1, number 628, volume number 9, number 86.
Dr. Morley's ministry is entitled Truth Seekers, and her mailing address is P.O. Box 250, Newport, Pennsylvania, zip code 17074. God bless you now. Goodbye.